young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
Jennifer Artis with us. She's the author of Blessing of Alzheimer's. And it's a situation she went through with her mother. Very valuable information about, and many people run through the same thing, but it's better to know beforehand to get into it so you can at least do some kind of anticipation. Jennifer, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. We call it a blessing of Alzheimer's. When you say a blessing, Jennifer, how do you mean that?
Well, it was when my mom was younger and with my dad, she had some problems with her mental times and she had some troubles. And for almost 20 years, she had troubles with her mind, and she imagined people were coming into her house stealing things, and she could see shadows that turned into people taking things from her and scaring her, and she was just in fear. And these were all delusions and not real, but to her, they were real.
And yeah, by the so way,
she,
yeah, Jennifer,
yeah, she had a lot of troubles.
Yeah, there's so many people who have, I'm going to call it the symptoms. They have those things, and they may not be recognizable for what they really are. And I would venture to guess, and I'm not a clinician, but I would venture to guess that there's so many people who go for professional help when that happens, and they don't tie into it's Alzheimer's. And if you're not working on the problem that you have, many, many problems that you didn't have to have can arise.
Well, that's probably true. And my mom didn't admit that she had trouble, of course, like so many do. She thought it was all real. She heard voices that would, she invented, they were doctors helping her. And they would tell her what to do and how to behave. And one time my dad did try to take her in for help, but these imaginary doctors said, don't take the medicine and act this way and they will let you go. And she did. And they couldn't keep her because she would be normal sometimes and then sometimes have these, in private with my dad, have these things where she would have to pile up chairs and tables against the door because someone was coming in. She was just
sure.
In fear for her life everywhere. And they moved a lot. They traveled a lot. And these things, they would go to, say, to Hawaii and come back the next day because somebody had followed her, she thought. And it was just really hard. And my dad tried for years to deal with it by himself, and it was really a hard hardship for him. And my sister and I had, you know, we had our own lives, and we lived far away. Sure. Not too far. I lived just 3 hours away, and my sister did live quite a ways up north and 12 hours away. But we would get together on the holidays and different events and noticed that my mom would have troubles. And we would talk about it afterwards, but my dad was in charge, and he, you know, he never asked for help. He just tried to take care of things, so we would just go back to our lives and, you know, kind of talk about it and wonder what was going on, but didn't know how to help, really. And it was at a funeral for my uncle where my aunt talked to my sister and I, and she took us out to the patio and said, you girls have to do something. Your mom is sick, and your dad, my brother, is all I have left. And her husband had just died, and we were at the funeral. It was quite a touching time, but it really hit us hard that, you know, she's right. We have to do something. We can't just go on. And mom wasn't taking good care of herself, and it was hard for dad, you know, when you're independent and each of you do your own thing, getting ready and the showers and dressing, you don't usually help each other as you go, as you're an adult. And but she did need help, and so we had a family meeting, and I had been looking for work. I was retired, but the situation that I had, I was looking for work, and so I said, Dad, I can help you. I need a meaningful job, and this could be that job, and take care of mom, and that would help you, and I would come down and live with you in your home. And so it was like a 100% commitment. I hadn't even you know, really planned ahead or thought about it. It was just on that weekend that we were down, and we had a serious family meeting, and just decided to go ahead and have home care for Mom. Don't take her to a home, or don't have somebody take care of her, because she was very paranoid of strangers and someone coming in and giving her a bath and dressing her. That just wouldn't have worked. That would have made everything worse for her.
And, Jennifer, let me ask you this, and I think it's a very important question. You decided to do it. How did you learn how to do it? And I think that's critical, because you can't just walk into something like that.
It is critical. But people are afraid to just do it. I ran a preschool. I owned and ran a preschool, and of course, dealing with the public, you have to have licenses, you have to have certificates, you have to hire teachers that are certified. But when you're taking care of your own kids, say, or you're taking care of your mom who becomes a child again, or your dad, you don't have to have that certificate. You don't have to have that training. You just have to have tons of patience, love, understanding, and a commitment that you decide 100% that you're going to be that person that goes back home and takes care of your needy family member.
And Jennifer said something very critical, very important, because what happens, they become the child again. And when they become the child again, it's a completely different relationship. You go from daughter to quote unquote mother keeper, to work with a parent. And I never had to do this, so I don't speak from experience. But to work with a parent as your child, and that's really what has to happen. It's got to be a tremendous transition. So there's got to be support for you, not only the person that you're working with.
Right, right. And I had my dad. He was right here with her. Helping, you know, assisting, and also thanking me 1,000 times a day for my help. Just, oh, Jenny, you're just such a blessing and such a help, and thank you. And Mom did. She couldn't speak anymore, but I would get her cleaned up in the morning and dressed and, you know, the earrings and lipstick, everything, hair done up. And she would go over to my dad, who would be probably reading or working on his, at his desk, and she would just stand next to him until he'd look up, and he'd say, "Oh, Joanne, don't you look beautiful?" And I just knew, you know, it just felt good. I felt like I was helping both of them, and I felt like I was doing something with my own time that was, you know, meaningful. It made me feel good. And our plan was I would take a whole year the first year, and then my sister would take over, and she would take the second year, and then back to me the next year after that. But the time went so quickly, that first year getting adjusted, it was really easy, and we had a hobby. My dad and I remodeled his boat, and so that kept us busy when we weren't taking care of Mom. You know, there's a lot of that other time where you have to be available, but you can't, you can't leave necessarily. Sure. But we had the lucky situation where our boat was right here at the channel, right here in front of their house. So we could work without leaving the home, and my mom would sit out on her patio swing and watch us for hours. And it was a great situation. And we got lucky. Mom was easy and peaceful, you know, nice. Whatever we wanted to do, she was, you know, going to do it with us. She was very easy to take care of. And it helped to think of her as a child, to take care of her as a, say, a two-year-old that needed to, you know, help eating, and they make a mess. You don't worry about it. You just put them in an apron or a bib and let them, you know, eat however they can. And you lock all the gates and the doors and make sure they can't escape, because if they could, they will. And that was a big worry for us, that she would check the front door over and over and over. And we had the doors that always opened so she could get out, but we had the gate in the front that was always locked. Well, you know, you always wonder, someday you might forget, you'd be in a hurry and rush. So we got her, we designed a pretty little gold bracelet. It was a medical bracelet that had her name on it, because she couldn't speak. She couldn't tell people where she lived or, you know, how to get back home or what her name was to even look it up in the the phone book.
Jennifer, let me hold you up. We're running out of time. Let me ask you this.
Sure.
Is there a website we can find you at where we can buy the book and find out more?
Well, you can peek in and read the almost the whole book if you go to the Amazon book section and look up A Blessing of Alzheimer's. It's there. And I have a website also, www.ablessingofalzheimers.com.
Wonderful. And Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're sure welcome.
Take care.
And I just wanted to add at the end, the reason why Alzheimer's is not necessarily a blessing, it's a hard way of life for your mind to get destroyed down to a childhood again. But the reason why I chose that terminology for my book, it became a blessing for my mom. She was in such a sad state of fear and turmoil in her life that she wanted to just run away, and she could have run away and had real trouble and died alone and really afraid. But she stayed home, and we took care of her, and she was happy at the end of her life because of the situations that took away some of the fears in her mind.
And okay, so Jennifer, we're out of time.
It turned out to be a good thing for us.
We're out of time.
Thank
I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
Okay, good night.
Hey, in those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And a love is burning light. We'll warm the winter night. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy.
Joy Huber with us, the author of Cancer with Joy, How to Transform Fear into Happiness and Find the Bright Side Effects. She was diagnosed with stage 4 as a young adult, stage 4 cancer, and she's a survivor and the founder of Cancer with Joy. She's an award-winning international presenter, an individual coach, a songwriter, and she helps the newly diagnosed and those on their support team discover how to transform fear into happiness with resources, with support, and encouragement, with a capital EN in encouragement. And she wrote Cancer with Joy to be the essential resource for the newly diagnosed, providing helpful and highly valuable information that saves. It's precious time. Seth, do we have anybody?
Hello.
Oh, there you are. Okay, we thought we lost you. Thank goodness you're here.
Yes. Well, hi. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Normally, when you're diagnosed, you, anybody, with stage 4 cancer, that's go home, pack it up, and sit it out because it's over with.
Right. You know, one thing that I have found is that people will ask, can cancer and joy really go together? And they say, tell me what this is all about. The title of the book and my talk definitely is something that grabs people's attention. Everybody wants to know if you can have cancer with joy. And then when they find out it's possible, they say, okay, how do I do it?
Okay, now, but let me ask you a question with your experience of it. Now, stage four cancer, what kind of cancer did you have?
I had lymphoma, more specifically non-Hodgkin's. Lymphomas are broken into two types. There's Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's, and then they more specifically get into subtypes. Of course, the more they know about what type of cancer you have, the more they can tailor and customize a specific therapy or treatment.
Okay, now effectively, cancer in and of itself, if you were to define it today, not necessarily, you know, the physically what it is, but emotionally what it is, what's cancer to you?
Well, to me, I would say the first few words that come to mind, being there as a real patient, hearing you have cancer, is I would say it's fear, terrifying, and almost a paralyzing. And that's why we put as the subtitle, how to transform that fear into happiness. We really want to help people transform that paralyzing feeling that they have into how can you have cancer and still be happy. And that's what I've discovered, and that's what I'm helping others do.
Okay, let me define it. Let me throw a definition on it from what I've heard you say from the few minutes we've talked, because I've heard the enthusiasm and the strength in your voice. Cancer would have to be probably one of the best things that ever happened to you, because it's created a legacy that goes beyond anything that you might have touched before. And the lives that you get to touch to move through this and maybe save some lives or make it easier on people if they can't get through it, there's a whole definition of it, and you have to take it to a different perspective and a whole different dimension.
Yeah, well, definitely, you know, I mean, I think cancer definitely means different things to a lot of different people out there, you know, based on any knowledge or experience you've had. That's one thing I found is after I got diagnosed, I always joke with people and say, you think kids say the darndest things? Some of the things adults would say to me when I mentioned my diagnosis to them just reminded me that we really take any word and we look at whatever knowledge, whatever experience we've had with it before, and that tends to be what comes out of our mouths, you know, even if it's something kind of uncomfortable to discuss, like cancer. A lot of my friends and family would even say to me, gosh, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. You know, I was a young adult, very healthy, so my diagnosis came as a big shock and surprise, and that's really one of the things that I help people with is I work with a lot of caregivers, caregiver groups, friends and family, and give them tips. How do you help your loved one face cancer using humor, using positivity?
Now, by the way, before you were diagnosed, before you went through it, did you have this kind of strength in your voice? Did people look at you as a strong person?
So, you know, I've always been a person that people say, wow, you really live up to your name. And so I've always been grateful my mom didn't name me disappointment or anger, or to then have someone say, wow, you really live up to your name. But I've always heard that. And that's really what was kind of cool when I got this idea. It was when I was in remission and was moving forward with the maintenance chemotherapy treatments. And that's kind of when the whole idea of helping others face cancer with joy, as I had done, hit. And I thought, wow, this is really cool, because you're Joy, who had cancer. Literally, they're facing it with you, but you're also helping them with the humor and the positivity.
One of the things one of the reasons that I asked you that question about your strength beforehand, if you take the very strong people, people who very much know how to live life, and there's a strength about them that people recognize, they respect for, and if they come down with something like cancer, it scares the people around them, because if it could happen to you, it can happen to me, which has had to be some kind of a problem in if somebody gets cancer and people start to shy away. You said it. They don't know what to say. They don't know what to ask. They don't know how to talk to you. And for the most part, it frightens them.
Right. Right, absolutely. And, you know, that's definitely something I wrote about very early when I was sharing my story. Cancer is such a great equalizer. It really doesn't care who you are. I was diagnosed in March of 2010, and that year Michael Douglas, the fantastic celebrity and actor, was battling throat cancer. And we all have heard countless stories of other celebrities and people that are well-known. You know, Patrick Swayze had passed from cancer. And, you know, it just reminds us that it really does not discriminate, and it can and does strike anybody, even helpless little babies. So,
no, by the way, in the book, and I've got the book in front of me, by the way, in the book, does it define fear? Does it give you the step-by-step roadmap to move through fear and to get your best out of it?
Yeah. You know, I don't specifically define fear, like according to dictionary.com, you know, or any standard definitions like that. What I do is I talk about, I think fear's kind of like success. And what I mean by that is that the definition is very individualized. So my definition of success may be different than your definition of success. And it's kind of something you have to decide individually. What is that emotion I'm feeling? And you pinpoint, is it fear? Is it sadness or depression? Is it anger? You know, am I bitter about this? And I definitely talk in the do's and don'ts chapter about feeling those emotions. Cancer with joy is not about, you know, being happy that you have cancer. I have a lot of people ask me that because they're very intrigued just by the title. And they say, does this mean I'm supposed to be happy that I have cancer? And I always respond, of course, no. No one is happy that they have cancer. But what I discovered and what I'm helping others do is that you can have cancer and still be happy. So as one of the do's and don'ts, I definitely say, hey, do get mad or sad or feel the emotions that you need to work through. So whether that's fear, bitterness, depression, I think everyone's going to experience an individualized set of emotions. Cancer with Joy is just about helping people not stay stuck there and moving to kind of living with that attitude of gratitude.
Now, by the way, Swayze got angry. I remember at the very end, he was really upset that this was going on. And the anger in and of itself can cause a tremendous amount of stress. Stress in and of itself can expedite what the effects of cancer are. I knew somebody a long time ago, 14, 15 years ago, that was diagnosed with stage 3B lung cancer. And they basically said he had to go have an operation, get the lung removed, and so on and so forth. And he was in his garage one day because he thought, well, he stayed in condition. And he thought, well, if I stay in good condition, the best condition I can be in, the operation's going to be a little bit easier. So he's on his exercise cycle, and he's just pumping away. And then it hit him, one of those epiphany moments. He thought, well, stop resisting, you know, and he made it okay to die. He didn't say he wanted to die, but he made it okay. If that's what's going to happen, then that's what will happen, and we'll do what we've got to do. The minute he did that, the stress joy disappeared. And when the stress disappeared, I'm sure his immune system kicked in, and that helped him to survive the operation and go on. So there's many, many things that you can do, and it doesn't mean don't be afraid. Sure, maybe you're going to be afraid, but the idea is stay away from the things that you know that are the stressors.
Yeah, yeah. And for sure, you know, when I speak to groups about that, I always ask them the idea of facing cancer with joy. I say, did it help me? Probably. You know, a lot of heads will nod, and I basically say, did it hurt me? And most people say no. You know, what does it hurt to approach things, obstacles in life with a positive attitude and using humor? In fact, one of the contributors who shares their story of how they face cancer with joy, in one of the chapters of the book, I collected stories from others, and they say that humor is the only alternative medicine that's not controversial. So what does it hurt to deploy or to use that, you know, in the fight? And I believe that it can certainly help along the way.
Oh, sure. No question about it. But let me ask you this. What kind of treatment did you have? Did you do allopathic medicine? Did you do the conventional, or did you go traditional? Did you go back to basics? And how did you handle it?
I definitely went more of a traditional route, and you know, I'm not a medical professional or expert in that, being a doctor, but so I wouldn't make any recommendations to anyone based on what they should pursue. I think that you should surround yourself with a team and gather opinions. That's definitely one of the do's in the book, as I say, do get a second opinion and ask a lot of questions of your medical professional and say, hey, what are you suggesting for treatment? What is this treatment based on? You know, how many others have you successfully treated? And the good news is today there are a lot of options out there in the cancer community. There's a lot of things out there where you can go what some would term the traditional medical route with surgery, radiation, chemotherapy. There's also the alternative routes. There's the idea out there that you can radically alter your diet, possibly get into juicing. You know, and again, I'm not a nutritionist or an expert, so what I focus on doing is helping people who've been diagnosed really face that challenge, giving them a lot of resources to help them save time and save their energy and save money while they're going through the battle.
By the way, that makes absolute sense. I would venture to guess that when somebody's diagnosed with cancer, it's not something that you go to school and learn how to handle. It's not something your family knows what to do with. So it takes people like yourself who have been there, done that, and can walk somebody through in such a way that they realize that they can make it through. The possibility of the ability to get through is one of the most important things. I think anybody with cancer or been diagnosed with cancer or somebody in family that has cancer can wrap their arms around.
Right, right. I mean, I haven't known anyone who wants to face cancer without joy. I haven't known anyone who says, yes, I want to face this without joy, without any hope, you know. Everybody that I meet, and I was really motivated to start this book project by being in so many cancer treatment centers, surgery centers, hospitals for various procedures, and definitely the majority of people I saw were facing cancer without joy. And I figured out as the real patient, you know, that everyone can relate to, that you can face cancer using humor, using positivity, and then I set out researching to find tons of resources, and I really put together the essential resource. The first third of the book fills you with inspiration. It's stories, it's funny examples from me and others about how you can face cancer, really inspires people to think differently about how they might handle the challenge. Then I get into do's and don'ts, share some information about health care and considering the finances, because of course a big part of responding to cancer with positivity is, as you said, not feeling the stress that come from finances, whether you're insured or uninsured. Then I also share a big section on how cancer impacts your relationships, your personal relationships as well as your professional relationships. And you have to consider everything from how you'll share your diagnosis with whom and when and who do they tell, as well as how cancer impacts your professional career, you know, and if you're self-employed. I've got information in there for caregivers, and then, as I said, a ton of resources. And I'll give you a quick example of that. A lot of people, when they're diagnosed with cancer, may go to the internet, because we tend to think that Google is our friend. And one thing I found, I actually made this mistake, is I was online Googling. Well, I had to remember, and I wrote that anyone can be a content provider these days. So a tip I give people is don't Google, don't go to the internet as your primary source of information. And some people say, gosh, I just can't stay offline before this doctor's appointment. What should I do? And I tell them about cancer.net. Cancer.net is a resource not a lot of people know about, and it gives you oncologist-approved information.
Wonderful. And Joe, I hate to do this to you, but we're running out of time. What website we can find you at and buy the book?
Yes, our website is cancerwithjoy.com, and up at the top I have links to some of the resources that I mentioned. There's more there. Like I said, there's 25 pages in the book, and you can get that on the right side of the website. It's also available pretty much everywhere, because a lot of folks out there have e-readers. They want to know if they can download it to their Kindle and Nook, and yes is the answer. So thanks for having me on with you.
Oh, my pleasure. And as we go, you know that guy with the exercycle that I was talking about? The one that the one I said that he said it was okay to die and dump the stress?
Okay, yes.
Yeah, you know what happened to him?
Okay, what happened?
He became a talk show host, and he interviewed somebody who wrote a book called Cancer with Joy.
Oh, wow, cool!
Joy, hey, thank you so much.
What was his name?
I wonder. it was 14
years ago. Was his name by chance Michael Dresser?
Oh, good guess. You've got to be psychic, too. Hey, Joy, we got to go, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Have a great night.
Take care. Good night.
Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging. You're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Bob Cantor with us. He's the author of the upcoming book, No Winner Ever Got There Without a Coach, A Guide to Personal and Professional Success. And every parent of a teenager is familiar with the angst and emotions of the teen years. As a matter of fact, if I was the dad of a teenager, I would probably be in jail right now. Even more challenging can be the struggles for control as teens try to become more autonomous. Let's talk to Bob Cantor. Bob Cantor's got the answers to fix this thing. Hey, Bob, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, teens today, the very interesting thing, I read a letter from somebody who was a psychologist and worked with kids, and she was the go-to person for the kids. And she was talking about, and this was in the last 10, 15 years or so, that she worked with suicide, she worked with rape, she worked with this, she worked with that. And I have to go back 30, 40, 50 years ago that we didn't have those things. And I think really what's going on is that inability for kids to say they're responsible for their own actions. There's got to be somebody there setting standards, setting guidelines, and something called consequence if you really want to have a decent life.
I totally agree. I guess the key here is that a lot of us don't realize that our relationship needs to take a turn when our kids make the transition from being, quote unquote, our kids,
yeah,
and turning into their own people. People ask me, why is it all of a sudden, and that's really the key here, all of a sudden so difficult for me to relate to my kid now that he or she is a teenager? And what I've learned over the years is that because the change up until that point tends to be very gradual, suddenly they make this left or right turn while we keep going straight ahead. And we don't realize that we've suddenly changed direction. And the turn that they take, I call something like, I'm not your little kid anymore.
Yeah.
And we always refer to our child, our son, our daughter. And when they get to this point, they now are not ours anymore. And as you were explaining a minute ago, they need to really assert themselves as the individuals that they're in the process of becoming.
Now, by the way, and I'll keep this a secret because we don't want to know who we're talking about, but Radio Susie's daughter, we didn't say it was her, but Radio Susie's daughter, 3-4 years ago, she was 18 years old, and she was living at home with her mom. And I remember I had gone over there, and for whatever reason, and I remember her daughter looked at her and said something about, I'm 18 years old, this is my body. And I looked at her and I smiled and I says, as long as you're living under your mom's roof, it's her body. And she took a look at me, but she got it. And when she moved out a few years later, I was kidding around with her one night and I said to her, guess what? What? I said, your body's yours. Do what you want with it. But that's really where it is. You know, I'm 18, it's my body. No, it's not. Not as long as you're living at home. Not as long as somebody's paying for your rent and your food and your education. It's not your body yet.
Well, you know, I would partially agree with you there. And I would liken that to when someone works for a company.
Yeah.
And they're getting paid by that company, which is essentially means that that company is helping to put a roof over their head.
Sure.
The company doesn't own that body. The company doesn't own that mind. And yet the company does have some rights and some expectations.
Yeah.
So what I've experienced and what my clients experience with teenagers is, how do you find a balance that respects your rights as the parent for everything that you are doing to enable this still young person to be successful,
sure,
and their right to begin to assert some independence within certain sets of guidelines and boundaries, which I think you talked about just a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah. And that's really the key. When I said to her, it's not your body, not that Susie owns her daughter, quote unquote, but there's got to be just what you said, that homeostasis, that balance, not that that was said, but she caught it. And it's very true. There's got to be that middle of the road, that neutral place where it's safe for everybody to express, but at the same time, realize there are consequences for your actions.
Well, an expression, I think, is one of the foundations here. You tell a story about Susie. I'll tell you my own wake-up story, and I won't mention my son's name.
No, we know there's no relation. Okay, go ahead.
So about 8 years ago, got into bed one evening, and my wife turned around and turned over to me and said, you know something, hon? If you keep treating Michael the way you've been treating him, you're going to drive him away from you, and you're going to lose him for good. And I was not real thrilled to hear that, but as I thought about it, I realized that she was absolutely right. And as unpleasant as it was important that I hear that. Because for the prior, I don't know, 6, maybe 7 or 8 months, he and I had been having fewer and fewer conversations, and the conversations we'd been having were leading us more and more towards yelling and in some cases screaming at each other. And as I lay awake all night long, I realized that my problem was that I had lost sight of what was really important to me in this relationship with my oldest son. And that was, it was about continuing to build our relationship, continuing to enjoy each other's company, and continuing to help each other grow and evolve as people. And I'd gotten trapped in this, well, everything he's doing is wrong, and I have to make sure that what he does is right. And because he does live under my roof, I get to call certain shots. And the harder and harder I was trying to help him do the right thing, as I was defining it, of course, the further and further away he moved. And as he was trying to demonstrate to me that he knew better than I did, it just got really horrible. So the next evening, when I got home from work and we sat down to dinner, I looked at him and I said, hey, Mike, your mom gave me some really harsh news last night. What she basically told me was what I was doing in our relationship was not working and that I was just making it worse and worse. And I realized that she had a point. And I'm sitting here tonight. I just want to say to you, I'd like to start again. And I'd like to remind both of us that the whole reason that we're here at the table as a family is because we love each other, we respect each other, and we want to be together. And I'll be the first one to say what I've been doing hasn't been working, and I'm not really sure how to fix it, but I want to let you know what I really want out of this relationship is that we get back to the warmth and the love, and I need your help to get us there. And the first thing that I'm going to do is ask you to help me understand what some of the things are that I've been doing that haven't been working for you. And I'm going to change the language just a bit. When he, in his response, he looked at me and said, "Well, Dad, you've been a real jerk." And of course, jerk wasn't the word that he used.
I got it. It was good.
I asked him to give me some examples of that. And he did. And a lot more than I was expecting. And after I listened to him for a while, I said, "Okay, I think I'm getting the gist of it. Let me tell you what I think I'm hearing about what I'm doing that's so wrong." And I explained it to him in my own words, shortened it a little bit. And I said, "Do you think I got it?" He said, "Yeah, I think you got it." I said, "Okay, that's really cool. You know, I understand that a lot of stuff I've been doing hasn't been working too well for you. Do you think that there's also another side to this conversation, which is what you've been doing that hasn't been working too well for me?" And he looked at me a little askance. And he said, "Yeah, I suppose." I said, "Would you give me a couple of minutes for me to give you some examples of some of the things that you do that make it hard for me to be more of a loving parent?" And he agreed. And I kept mine a lot shorter. And I said, "So you see, Mike, we're both right and we're both wrong. And the bottom line here is that what we're doing together isn't really satisfying, at least not satisfying me, and I don't think it's satisfying you either. Do you want more out of the relationship just like I do?" And he admitted that he did. And so on the spot, we made an agreement that moving forward, when one of us did something that really, really bothered the other one, instead of getting into an argument, we'd look and say, "Hey, remember the dinner conversation where we said when something happened, we would make note of it and try to work it out? Well, something just happened." And that became our code for "Let's Talk."
Wonderful. Bob Cantor with us, co-author of the upcoming book, "No Winner Ever Got There Without a Coach, A Guide to Personal and Professional Success." Call us toll free if you got a question, 1-888-429-5471. That's 1-888-429-5471. Bob, when we take a look at kids today, they're obviously, it's a different culture, it's a different climate, it's a different the value system. But if you really come down to it, if you would have sat down with your son 50 years ago and said the same thing as you said today, you would have gotten the same kind of response. So the message really is there's a language, there's a communication style to speak to one of your children and to get that bonding back or create it if you've never had it. It's ageless. It's timeless.
Well, you know, I guess it was Covey who might have said many years ago that people don't care what you have to say until they know that you care about them. And when you make your intentions clear and your intention is something that is caring and loving, you know, you're right. Whether it's 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 200 years ago, in the last 200 years, the wiring of who we are as people hasn't really changed.
Yeah.
Maybe over 10,000 years or so, but we're still the same people we were a couple of hundred years ago.
No, absolutely. And it's a culture that we live in. And in that culture, there's two things that have to happen if you want connection of any kind. One is acceptance. And the other one, which is derived from the acceptance, is something called identity. You gave him, you accepted him, and you also gave him a renewed identity as part of the family.
Well, and respecting that identity and reinforcing that identity is where the trust and the mutual respect comes from as well.
Yeah.
So if I'm working with you, whether you're a coworker, whether you're my boss, whether you report to me, whether you're my son or my daughter, to the extent that I can help you develop an identity that makes you feel good, that makes you feel appreciated, you're going to respect me and be willing to work with me in kind. To the extent that I belittle you and knock you down, you're going to treat me in kind.
Sure. And by the way, I don't want to be repetitious or repeat myself, but coming from your words, which make all the sense in the world, the three things to get it together is called intention, intention, intention.
Right. So what I had to do when I was going through this was remember what was truly important to me. And when I reconnected with Michael, what I was able to do was remind him what was really important to him as well. And I do this in the business environment as well. When we lose track of our core values, going back to the term you used a few moments ago, and we get caught up in the moment. So in the moment, it may be, my son has stayed out past curfew. He knows that that's against the rules. He obviously doesn't care what I think. He doesn't respect me. This is wrong. It shouldn't be wrong. I deserve to be right. You get caught up in all of that. And then you find yourself arguing about what is right. And unfortunately, when we get ourselves caught up in proving that we're right, we hook the other person and they have to prove that, well, no, we're not right. They are right. And we lose track of another core concept that I feel is critical, and that is we need to be helpful. It's not enough to be right. You can be right and really turn somebody off. And the examples that I use there when I do coaching is that if you've ever been trying to break an unwanted habit, whether it's losing weight or smoking, and someone sitting with you says to you, are you sure you really want to light up that cigarette right now? Or are you sure you really want that third cookie? They're right in terms of what you're trying to achieve, but what does that do to you? How do you respond and react to that? And now imagine that scenario with a teenager who admittedly is not the most level-headed individual in the world because of all of their hormonal changes that they're going through, and you've now taken a match to a gasoline can.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No question about it. I think the answer to that, the fix to that would be knowing what to do when that can blows up. And that is quote-unquote coaching. Somebody has to take you by the hand and say, these are the possible outcomes, and this is the way you deal with each individual outcome that pops up. Because it's the ability to anticipate, to make sure that you know what's going to happen before it happens. Because we're not taught these things, Bob. There's not a school that you can go to, high school, maybe the beginning of college, unless you're going to specialize in something that teaches you how to be in a family, that teaches you how to get married, that teaches you how to deal with money. And I mean, this list goes on. It's when you get out there in the street and get knocked down and learn, that's when this happens.
Well, we call that the school of hard knocks, don't we?
Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. But you take guys like yourself, who, you take your book, which is coming out, and you condense it, and it's taken all the years that it has taken you to learn that. You got it in a couple hours that somebody does not have to go through that if they'll participate in the book.
Well, and I can go one step further and make an offer. If people who are listening to this have questions, they can feel free to send me an email at bobkantor, that's BOBKANTOR, at hotmail.com. And I'll do my best to respond. If I get a lot of questions that are similar, then I'll just do answers in my blog posts or on my Twitter account and try to get back to people that way.
Dynamite. Bob, we're just about out of time. Again, please, your website.
Okay. It is www.simplerleadership.com. That's simpler as in S-I-M-P-L-E-R, leadership.com.
By the way, when the book comes out, we can find it on the website?
It will be on the website, and for anyone who follows me on Twitter as Bob Kantor, I will also keep everyone up to date as to what's going on with the release of the book.
Wonderful. Hey, Bob Kantor, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Michael, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance.
Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me. So.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Essays and Idleness. Ardwaine Seaman with us. Ardwaine Seaman, as a matter of fact, he was there. He was on the inside. He was the NASA project supervisor when the Columbia disaster happened. February 2003, NASA reported the space shuttle Columbia was lost during reentry into the Earth's atmosphere, resulting in the death of all seven crew members. And now with this event, Columbia became the second space shuttle disaster, the voyage, to end in this kind of tragedy, and the first shuttle lost while attempting to land. And the initial cause cited by NASA was immediately challenged and disputed by Dwayne Seaman. Dwayne, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
By the way, thank you so much for being here. When you take a look at it from your eyes, which are different from most people seeing it, they weren't there, they weren't schooled the way you're schooled in these kind of projects. What did you see? What caused that disaster?
Well, first of all, I was not with NASA when that happened. I left NASA and started a company called AIM Financial Systems Group, and ended up 28 years later as the president and CEO. However, as soon as I saw the reports of the accident, I knew that what was being said could not be true.
Go ahead. I was going to say, that when we talk about something like that, was there a cover-up? Did somebody not do something that they were supposed to do? Are there things that we should have known that would have caused a problem, let's say, higher up the ladder?
Well, I wouldn't call it a cover-up. However, NASA was, in my opinion, reluctant to, really look into it because they were asking for $15 billion, and they wanted to appear squeaky clean. The main thing that hit me as soon as I saw the report was they said it broke up over Texas. That's impossible. The debris was found near Winoxie, Texas, which is close to Dallas. But on reentry, and that's when it happened, they're coming in at 12,500 miles an hour, between 12,500 miles an hour and 15,000 miles an hour, and the pilot has to use the retro rockets to re-enter. Otherwise, he'd go shoot out into space or continue to orbit the Earth. With that kind of speed, had it broken up over Texas, it would have the inertia would have carried the debris to Louisiana or Alabama or somewhere like that. So that struck me immediately. And 1 year later, I was vindicated when NASA revised their reports. But the media and NASA both were reporting that that it broke up over, there was an explosion over Texas. Secondly, there was no explosion. If you look at the video of the reentry of the space shuttle, you'll see that it was disintegrated. There wasn't any fireball or anything like that. So it was impossible to have broken up over Texas. And I took exception to that immediately. All of this is a chapter in my book which I'm trying to sell, called Essay in Idleness. And the thing about reentry is it's very, very precise. And the pilot, Humble, is responsible for using retro rockets to get a 40-degree angle reentry so that they can land back in Florida. And at some point, I believe, and I think they both decided later that NASA, the initial problem occurred probably over the Pacific Ocean or maybe California, something like that. And as I said, there was no explosion, it was disintegration. And there was...
Dwayne, let me hold you up. And by the way, how does NASA, how do we get different information? They're very sophisticated. We know they are. They've got their fingers on the pulse of everything that goes on. What was it that caused us to get the wrong information?
Well, as they started reentry, now the pilot really doesn't have anything to do until reentry. He's not involved on liftoff, and he's not involved during the orbit of the Earth. And he's not just sitting there. They do other things. They experiment, and they go to the bathroom. They eat, that sort of thing. So he's not in that seat all the time. But at some point, NASA engineers noticed a remarkable correction by the autopilot, the worst ever. And it was within limits, but it was the worst ever correction that the autopilot made. This led me to believe that it was either pilot error or maybe space junk or something. There's an awful lot of space junk up there that caused the autopilot to react violently. And that put stress on the whole spacecraft. And that just caused the disintegration. It was not a fire. It was not a foam. On the initial liftoff, there was a picture of piece of foam coming loose. And also, I might point out that on reentry, unlike the Apollo, which I was involved in, the space shuttle comes in upside down. In other words, the heat shield is facing away from Earth. So the pilot has to flip it. And during the flip operation, he could have made a mistake or whatever it was that caused the autopilot to react the way it did and cause the disintegration. It could have been it could have been pilot error. His knee could have hit the stick. Whatever it was, the autopilot reacted violently, and that caused the disintegration, which started, by the way, over the Pacific Ocean or California, and the debris ended up in Texas. Had that happened over Texas, as media first reported, the inertia alone would have carried the debris many, many miles eastward.
Dwayne, let me ask you this: Had Columbia got here, had there not been that problem, whatever happened at this stage of the game, what would we have learned? What did we miss by Columbia not fulfilling the mission?
Well, we learned a lot of things. You know, Gus Grissom and a couple of other guys died on Pad 39 on a simulated visit to the moon. We learned from all these mistakes. Now, the space shuttle, the Columbia, was not equipped with EVA. That's extravehicular excursion. That's where they can go out and check and see what's wrong. Had they had EVA, they may have been able to go outside if it was something that could have been corrected. But like I said, I truly believe that it was a pilot error or the autopilot trying to avoid space junk. There's an awful lot of space junk up there. Whatever it was, the autopilot had a violent reaction which caused the spaceship to disintegrate, not blow up.
Now, Dwayne, the book in and of itself is not just about the Columbia disaster. Define idleness, essays and idleness. How do we take that word idleness and apply it to Columbia, and where else in history have we seen problems because of that?
Well, the title of the book, I'm a nut for writing things down that interest me. And like I said, this is only one chapter. I'm retired, and that's where the idleness part comes from. So I took my idleness and put it to work writing this book. And like I said, this is only one chapter in the book. I also talk about the Great Depression, growing up during the Great Depression, and all the hardships that we had. There are a lot of, I have reflections and about myself and religion and meaning and expectations, all these things. For instance, I say that to expect things is wrong, because the only way that a person can be disappointed is to expect something. If you don't expect it and it happens, you're not disappointed. And that sort of thing, there's a lot of different genres in the book. And the Essays in Idleness is just one chapter.
Okay, but when we look at it, and just out of curiosity, you know, there's the Great Depression, World War II, China, religion, the war in Iraq, and there's so much more in the book. Is there an overarching theme all the way from the Depression forward that you see that we keep stumbling on ourselves about?
Well, I think just like we interpret things wrong at times, just like we did with the shuttle. And, of course, the Depression was something that I was only a child, but and we finally came out of it. But it's something that is just right now, for instance, the Depression that's going on in Europe. There isn't really much we can do about it except try to live with it.
And by the way, so if we see things, let's go back to, and stop me if I'm wrong here, and I don't want to get political, but history has a habit of repeating itself. You can see things happen, and if we can learn from the past, we do okay. Hitler walked into Germany, and he got everybody involved and excited, and he gave them what he called identity. He began nationalizing the banks, the schools, the businesses, and so on and so forth. Do you see that kind of a thing starting to happen again in our own country here?
Yes, I do, to a certain extent. I think that we have some problems that we need to straighten out. The economy has improved a little, but I'm not sure that we're totally out of it. I just heard recently that gas prices will probably go up to as high as $5 this summer.
Yeah,
so we're not making any progress in that respect, but politics enter into it. I understand that President Obama has put aside the pipeline that's supposed to run from Montana down to the Gulf Coast. And it's, you know, politics get involved in these things, and I wouldn't say that. I would say that World War II, for instance, just in my own opinion, President Roosevelt was the president at the time, and we were in a horrible depression, and I think he saw a way for us to get out of the depression by entering into the war. And we antagonized the Japanese, and they attacked us, and that gave him the incentive to go to war against them and the other Axis powers.
No, by the way, war does make money. You know, the manufacturers, the plants that go on, the people that have put the work, and so on and so forth. There's no question about that. And I really believe what we're taking a look at today is nothing more than a repeat of history. If you look at and you go back, and I bet we could find some kind of familiarity through the Depression, World War II, China, religion, Iraq, and the rest of it. There's going to be overarching themes that we don't look at, or we choose not to look at, and because we don't look at them, we get ourselves into a tremendous amount of trouble. This decision with Obama and the pipeline had nothing to do with whether it was good or bad for the country. If you take a look at it, and it's documented, he's stopping it because he doesn't like the way Congress is dealing with it, and he's not going to do it their way. He's going to do it his way, and that's what's stopping that. So we have to look at all of those things and what causes all the variables to come into play which cause the decisions that are made that affect us. And I really believe Essays in Idleness, you have and I'm going to call it a historical book. You have historical books, and if you read it, you get involved in it, and you see it. it can cause you not to have you as we as a people, not to have the problems that we're having now, because it could have been stopped someplace.
Well, I agree, and I think that we have we're guilty of getting involved in things that we probably shouldn't. I have a chapter on Iraq and China, and I don't think that we have any business in Iraq, and I wrote that particular article or chapter when we first entered the Iraq War, and we've lost, what, 20-some thousand of our young people as a result. I'll go back to what I said about expectations. I said that you should not expect, you should hope. Hope is eternal. Expectations, if something happens that you really like, you're excited and elated, but if it doesn't, if you're expecting it all along and it doesn't manifest itself, then you become disappointed. That's the only way that you can become disappointed. And I think that hope is essential in all of our thoughts and daily activities.
Yeah, no question about it. Dwayne, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and also buy the book and follow along with what you're doing?
Yes, I appreciate the interview. I have the book can be, it's called Essays in Idleness, and it's available through Barnes & Noble or Amazon.com. Now, if anyone would like a signed copy, they can email me at rdseaman@sbcglobal.net. I'll say that again. It's rdseaman@sbcglobal.net. I also have a website. It's called My Essays in Idleness, because the Essays in Idleness domain name was used previously. So if you go to myessaysinidleness.com, and then at the very top of the bar, click the top of the bar, then they can get, they can order it that way. But if they'd like a signed copy, and book sales are doing very well, and it might be worth something someday, they can contact me at my website, or they can call me. I'll give you my phone number. It's area code 816-833-5758. That's area code 816-833-5758. I appreciate your opportunity to let me talk.
By the way, Dwayne, thank you so much for being here. Take care. Have a great evening.
Thank you so much.
Good night.
Just a jackknife has old to make a heat, babe. And it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with its teeth, baby, scarlet below stop to spread. But fancy gloves, though, wears old Omega Heat, baby. So there's never, never a trace of red. I let them things swing on a sidewalk. Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Beep! And someone sneaking round the corner. Tell me, could that someone be Mac the Knife? Oh, there's a tugboat down by the river, don't you know? Well, cement bags just hanging on down. Oh, that cement is there strictly for the weight, dear. Five will get you 10. Old Mackey's back in town. Hey, hear about Louis Miller. He done disappeared, dear. After drawing out, feels good. All his hard-earned cash. And now Mackey, he spends just like a shaver. Could it be our boy's done something rash? Come on, come on. Jimmy Diver, ho, 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 shooty tawdry. Hello, Miss Lottie, didn't ya? Good evening, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right bay. And now that Mackie's back in old L.A. town. Sugar Tawdry,
Sit back, Lottie Lynn, yeah. Move it over, Lucy Brown. Oh, the line forms way on the right, babe. And now let Mackie back in town.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michael Clare with us. He's the Five College Professor of Peace and World Security Studies, a joint appointment at Amherst, Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, and Smith Colleges in the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, a position he's held since 1985. He is the author of The Race for What's Left, The Global Scramble for the World's Last Resources. He's written widely on U.S. defense policies, the armed global resource politics, and world security affairs. He's the author of several books on these topics, including most recently, again, The Race for What's Left, The Global Struggle for the World's Last Resources. And let us say, Michael, I welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Michael.
And thank you so much for being here. You know, we're looking at a potential disaster when it really comes down to it. Everybody's fighting for what may not be there for a long time. We look at alternatives and so on and so forth because we know that the oil resources are not going to be there forever. And it's the big battle. But, Michael, do we really see what there is to see, or is there things underneath it that we normally don't see that drive this big scramble?
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know, we live in a world of many powerful forces. We have we have the rise of China and the rise of India, with hundreds of millions of people entering the middle class and buying cars all of a sudden, so the demand for oil is rising. At the same time, the world supply of oil is diminishing. So you have very powerful forces in collision, and of course the oil companies are doing their very best to benefit from all of this by charging whatever they can get from us to get what's left of this oil.
Oh, no question. I think one of the biggest problems that we have also is at the base where the oil is drilled from. I'm going to pick some numbers out just so we can get a feel here. You might talk about, from the well, $5 or $6 a gallon, and by the time that it's shipped, and by the time it hits taxes, and by the time it hits whatever, you're talking about $100+ a gallon. So the actual the cost of it is nowhere near what the end result of being charged for is.
Yeah, I think you mean by the barrel, and a barrel by the barrel has 42 gallons, and you're absolutely right about that. The production cost may be a small part of it, but the fact is that all of the easy oil is now gone, or most of the world's easy oil. By that I mean the kind where you stick a drill into the ground and you go down a few hundred feet and the oil comes spurting out. That stuff is mostly gone. What's left is deep offshore. We have to spend $1 billion on a very complicated rig like the Deepwater Horizon and penetrate several miles underground before you hit oil, or in the Arctic, or in very complicated geological formations, shale oil and the like. So
sure.
the price of production is rising exponentially because all the easy stuff is gone. What's left is very hard to get at, or it's in war zones like Iraq, and you have to fight wars to get your hands on it.
Oh, sure. And the prices themselves, crude oil prices, they're determined by worldwide supply and demand. I mean, there's no question about that. And they're influenced by OPEC, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. I think there is a problem also. So the cost of oil in and of itself, the end result of that oil turned to gasoline, whatever the case may be, it's political. And there is money behind it. Where there's no question. There's the old adage, you know, you want to find out what's going on, follow the dollars. And from the time that we take a look at what it costs us per gallon right here in the United States, you can't really forecast. And that $5 a gallon that they're projecting by, let's say, summertime, there are so many variables involved in that. that the average person has no idea what's going on. All they know is it's going to cost $5 a gallon. And it has to do with what's going on in the world, country to country, the politics, the ideology, the financial impact that it'll have from country to country. And let's look at a brand right now who's saying we're going to block the straits, and because we block the straits, the price is going to go up. So all of these things are involved in going to the pump and getting a gallon of gas.
Yeah, well, you've described that very well, I have to say. The thing that I would add to your description, which is very good, is that the United States has long been the dominant factor in the world's oil market because historically the United States has been the major consumer of oil. But now you have to contend with the fact that China and India increasingly and Brazil and Turkey and other countries are increasingly major consumers of oil as well. So they have a voice in the market forces too. China is catching up with us, will soon be competing with us on equal terms for what's left of the world's oil. And as you probably know, we're deeply in debt to China in the tune of $1 trillion or so because of all the dollars that they hold. So they have a certain advantage in that marketplace.
Yeah, and we take a look at it, how we got into this position with China, most people will never know. You know, we're constantly buying imported goods from China. They take the money that they make from us, and they end up, for the most part, putting it into their military, putting it into weapons that they sell to people like Iran and so on and so forth. So those dollars flow in some very interesting places.
Yeah, now their military is still nowhere near as powerful as ours, so we shouldn't, you know, see too much there. They're still way behind in military technology, but they are using that money that we spend to buy up oil fields around the world, and that's something that I'm watching very closely in the competition for what's left of the world's oil and other natural resources. The Chinese are buying up everything in sight, wherever that you look, in Africa and Latin America and Central Asia. They're buying up oil fields, natural gas fields, diamond mines, because they have this surplus of cash.
Well, let me ask you this question, and let's look at it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Let's give you, Michael, let's give you the magic wand. And the magic wand means you are the leader of the entire world. What would you do to fix the problem?
Well, Michael, thank you for giving me all this power.
And you're very welcome.
The fact is that we are running out of most of the world's major vital resources, oil and other energy sources, many minerals, agricultural land, because we're consuming so much all of the time. So these things are disappearing. So if I had a magic wand, it would be to get people to start using things, anything, whatever, things more efficiently, more economically. We have to use cars that are more fuel efficient. We have to build houses that are more energy efficient. I mean, and worldwide, not just here, everywhere, because otherwise we're going to use up what's left of the planet very rapidly, and then we're going to be in a real mess.
No, absolutely. Let me jump in just for a second, because one of the things that I've seen happen is this. Now we have the electric car that's going to get you, 100 miles to the gallon and yada, yada. But, Michael, that car is going to cost you $100,000. You know, and if we do, and by the way, I'm a proponent of alternative energy. There's no question about it. But the problem with that is not going to happen overnight. And we have a problem right now. We have Texas, where there's untapped resources there. Go along the Canadian border. Our states on this side have a tremendous amount of untapped natural resources that we can get into right now. Alaska, they haven't even scratched the surface yet there. And for some reason, we are not looking at any of this.
Not quite true, Michael. There's no question there's a lot of hydrocarbon material there. But like I say, it's not the easy stuff. It's not like you could drill into it and a pool of oil comes out. It's all embedded in rock. So you have to smash the rock, and that's very expensive and difficult to do. So the oil companies are very well aware of this. The Bakken Formation in North Dakota and the Marcellus Formation, they're aware of this, and they're developing the technology to get at it, but it's much more expensive than conventional, traditional means of getting oil. And this is all a signal that the days of oil are coming to an end, because we're going after the second best and third best stuff. And that tells me only that we have to use what's left much more efficiently so we get more bang for the buck.
Oh, sure. No question about it, but you talk about the shale oil, right?
Shale oil and other kinds of, and the Canadian tar sands. There's a lot of Canadian tar sands I think you were talking about, but it's very, very expensive to convert that stuff into a usable liquid. It's
Michael, what
not
about
a
Mexico?
Conventional process.
Yeah, but what about Mexico?
Mexico's running out. They were once a major supplier to the U.S. They're going to be a major importer of oil in another 10 years because their stuff has all been depleted. Bye-bye.
Okay, so in essence, so let's say, for instance, that everybody takes a realistic look at this and say, we have to go alternative. We have to create these things. How long will it take us to get there?
It's going to take us a while, Michael, and that's why I say that efficiency is what's important. You were saying electric cars a while ago, and I agree with you. That's going to be a difficult step. But Detroit is perfectly capable of producing cars that get 50 miles a gallon, I mean oil-powered cars, but that are just twice as efficient as the ones that we have now. And they've had that technology for a long time. That's not rocket science. That's what I'm talking about, using oil much more efficiently and other resources more efficiently.
Yeah, but by the way, Michael, let me give you my fix to this entire thing. This is what I truly believe. If we as a nation, and then it can expand out, come to the table values neutral. You're not a Democrat, I'm not a Republican, or whatever the case may be, either way, nobody carries the baggage that's attached to all of it at this stage of the game. And we're here to do construction. Most debates, they're always about right and wrong. So what's wrong with building from here? Leave the gotchas at the door. Instead of embellishing these old ideas that are causing us problems, create workable standards to live by, something that works for you, for me, for everybody, and not at the expense of someone else. I think this would give us a very viable starting point. And maybe it's not the be-all, end-all, but it would be a beginning, a place to start, because if we don't do this and if we don't come together, we're going to have a major problem. It's called stay conscious, stay alert, and we're not doing that right now.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That would be my philosophy as well. Another way of thinking about the same thing is about the next generations. I teach young people in the college level, and, you know, I worry about the world that they're going to face in another 20 or 30 or 40 years, when the resources that we could enjoy today are going to be gone or much more expensive. So I feel that we have an obligation to them, to my son and our grandchildren coming along. They're going to be in a much more difficult place unless we start working together now to make the changes that'll be necessary so that they could enjoy a standard of living somewhat like ours.
Yeah, somebody needs to tell Congress that. Somebody needs to tell the administration that. And I don't just mean the current administration. Every administration. It would be something. I happen to be a moderate conservative. But the point here is this. All the problems didn't happen in the last three or four years. This has been going on continuously. The oil problems, the problems. Administrations come and go, Michael, but it's always the same thing building. So there's got to be an inherent problem somewhere.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of it has to do with worrying about the next quarterly dividend and, you know, the next round of profits, and not thinking about our country as something that we pass on to the next generation and thinking about it that way. I think that would be a true conservative value, but I don't see conservatives often talking that way.
And by the way, I don't see anybody really talking that way. No. When it comes down to we are a culture of a rewards-based society. You know, you want somebody to do something for you, you give them something. Your mom says to you, clean up your room, we'll take you to the show. You do this, you get candy. We've got to a point where on both sides of the aisle, I'm going to vote for you if you're going to give me something. I'll do this for you if you do that for me. And our independence and our ability to strike out and be what we want to be, when we want to be it, and be the best we can be, seems to be diluted. And a lot of this has got to do with the problems that you and I are talking about worldly, with the resources that keep us, they give us the ability to maintain and sustain a lifestyle.
Yeah. Well, I'm complete accord with you about that.
Yeah. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. And I could talk to you all night, actually. Do you have a website we can find you at and get the book?
Well, I'm at Hampshire College, so people should just go to the Hampshire College website and then look for me. And my book is going to be out in about a month's time. People could pre-order it at Amazon.com, of course. It's The Race for What's Left. And it's
wonderful.
About the assault on the world's final resource preserves, like the Arctic and the oceans and places like Afghanistan and Mongolia. We're really coming up against what's the very last of what the Earth has for us, so we have to start thinking about doing things differently.
I hear you. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Good night.
Hey, good night.
And a love is burning light. We'll warm up in a night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all. Splish splash, I was taking a bath. Long about a Saturday night. Rubbed up, just relaxing in the tub. I'm thinking everything was alright. Well, I stepped out the tub, I put my feet on the floor. I wrapped the towel around me and I opened the door. And then a splish splash, I jumped back in the bath. Well, how was I to know there was a party going on? There was a splishing and a splashing, reeling with the feeling, moving and a grooving, rocking and a rolling. I saw the whole gang dancing on my living room rug.
We would do the intro and start the show, but Radio Susie is dancing, and I can't stop her.
Molly Papa with a Peggy Sue. Golly, Ms. Molly, there too.
Then leave her show with us. Written about antiques and collectibles since 1995, which includes several rock and roll-related articles, a boomer herself, as a preteen and a teenager, and her first dance instructor mother taught the moves of the day, the jitterbug, the stroll, the hand jive and the twist. I remember the twist. Don't tell anybody. And even the ankle wiggling mashed potato. Lindy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. What an intro. And I can just see Susie dancing there, you know?
It was a fun time,
and the music is awesome.
Oh, tell me. I was brought up with it, and now we're going to keep this secret, but I remember going to school dances and doing the twist.
Absolutely. And do you know that it was actually banned in Catholic schools?
Was it really?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
We can't remember that far back. Thank goodness for history books, you know?
Yeah, and all that good stuff. Let me give you another interesting one. Do you remember Rock With Me, Henry? No, she said no. Do you remember that rock?
Barely.
Okay, barely. I love it. Okay. All right. Rock With Me, Henry was really heavy duty when I was in the 7th, 8th grade. And they had to change. It was Rock With Me, Henry, All Night Long, Roll With Me, yada, yada. And they changed it to Dance With Me, Henry, because it was too risque.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the first songs that came out with the term rock and roll were actually as early as 1937 with Ella Fitzgerald and Won't You Satisfy My Soul with the Rock and Roll, but she was talking about the Lord, my dear.
Yeah. No, I got it.
We've had rock and roll, but...
All right. Now, by the way, the first... Go ahead.
What was that? No, that's okay. I was just going to say, I think the first rock and roll hit that they called rock and roll anything anyway was by the Crows called G in 1953. That's what I understand anyway.
Well, way, way before my time. Anyways, the blast from your past, rock and roll rock and roll radio DJs, the first 5 years, 1954 to 1959. Ask me what I was doing in 1954 to 1959.
What were you doing, Michael?
Funny you should ask that. I was in junior high school and high school. I graduated in 1960. I lived everything you're talking about here.
Did you really? See, we need to talk.
Yeah.
Off air.
Yeah, absolutely. No, this stuff is great. I was brought up with it. And I was serious about, we'd go to school dances, we do the twist, and we do all of that good stuff. I mean, this is
Well, did you do any DJ work when you were in high school?
No. We were too cool. Those were the days.
Did you have a pair of blue suede shoes?
Yeah. Wait. That's not a joke. Yes. And there were the we had black suede shoes. And I remember in those days. White bucks, yes, and white pants, yes. I remember all that good stuff.
The white buckskins, yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And there was...
And the T-shirts with the cigarettes rolled up in the shirt sleeve, that was no movie thing. You know, it wasn't just James Dean. Everybody was doing it that smoked. Of course, I didn't do that.
No, but we did, of course not. But we did. I remember rolling it up in a shirt sleeve, and I remember, now, this is the old days, we used to use butch wax on our hair. And it was rolled up on both sides with a curl in front and a DB. Well, actually, it was a DA, but to be nice, it was a DB, a duck butt.
Yes.
That was the style in those days, and we were cool. I remember when the Blackboard Jungle played, we were at the local movie theater, and we were wearing leather jackets and things. I can't remember how old I was. It could have been more than, 13 or so. And I remember walking out, and everyone took their leather jackets, and the collars went up. We were cool.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What caused you to
do this? Do you know that the movie On the Waterfront was one that, when it hit, it brought out the... What was the song that made that popular? Gosh. Slips my mind right now. It was one of the first ones, though.
I'll call you for
it. Anyway, but the movie itself actually created riots in England.
Really?
And they were dancing in the aisles.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Now, I've remember gotten some really good trivia.
No, good trivia.
I've gotten some really fun trivia on this stuff.
But what I liked about it was that more than anything else, it was innocent. That's really where it was. It wasn't, drug-induced and go chase whatever. It was innocent. Everybody was doing it. It was one of those. And in those years, especially if there was a bedroom scene in the movie, law now, 1 foot had to be on the floor.
That was true. That went all the way through the 60s. Remember with the sitcoms on TV?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was the same thing. Yeah.
Okay, now, where was it? What caused you to look at this and do what you've done with it? Because I think it's great.
Well, I've been having a real blast with it, to coin a word. And I've been a magazine writer for quite a long time with regional magazines. And one of the Southern California magazines a few years back asked me to do an article on rock and roll memorabilia, because I've written a lot, 15, 20 years on antiques and collectibles.
Yeah.
And so I went ahead and did an article for them, which was really difficult because you're trying to pack, I mean, whatever you want to as far as rock and roll memorabilia into 1,000 words. And so it was a difficult article to write. But in the doing of that, I contacted a couple of friends of mine. One of them was a DJ in Phoenix at the time. And we were talking about radio memorabilia from that era. And we just got to talking. A couple of DJs had passed away, and we were lamenting that, you know. And I'm going, you know, before they all go away, maybe we need to do some stories on them and capture some of those fun times that they had, and, you know, leave a legacy for DJs. And it just kind of blossomed from there. And one book is just not going to do it.
Yeah, I remember we used to. Now, in those days, we didn't have gangs. I mean, I'm sure there were a few gangs around. I was brought up in Southern California. We had car clubs.
Mm-hmm.
We would drive around the car clubs. And the worst thing we would do was mischief, all right? And then we'd call in, and whatever DJ was on the air, they'd say, this is for the Tartars from, you know, Bell, California, and yada, yada, yada. And we had all of those things, and everybody was dedicating a song, and the DJs talked to people. Yeah, it was a whole different world.
It was. And, you know, there are still a few DJs around nowadays, but they don't have that personal connection. And actually, Bill Gardner, who is the friend that I was talking to when I first started the magazine article, he wrote an introduction for me. And that was his comment, is that there was that connection between the radio DJ and the listeners that you just can't have now, because radio is completely different, you know.
Yeah, and you know what we had in those days also? We had the drive-in movie. You don't see them anymore. Yeah. What we used to do, we can't tell anybody about this. This is a secret now.
No, don't tell anyone.
Is there'd be a couple in the front seat and a couple in the back seat, and about six of us jammed into the trunk. And we'd get into the movie, they'd open the trunk, and everybody get out, and they'd get in the car. Oh, yeah. The fun. That was good stuff.
And did anyone ever actually watch the movie?
No. No.
We won't talk about what we did.
Well, right.
But we had a really good time.
Okay. All right.
And
now, here
the radio was always on. Even, you know.
Let's see if you remember.
Especially before the movie started.
No. Let me see if you remember this. This goes memory. Now, we used to do this when I was with 7th, 8th, 9th grade. You'd go into the movie. Friday nights we went to the movies. Saturday we also went to the movies. But Friday night especially. You got into the movie and there'd be three girls. See, in those days you could say girl. There would be three girls sitting in front of you, 12, 13 years old or whatever it was. And then you'd walk around on the side, and one of us would be on, let's say, I'd be on the left side. And then we're watching the movie, and the arm would go up across the back of the seat. Then it would drop over to the shoulder. Now, if she moved away, you were in trouble. But if she didn't, it was okay. Then came the first kiss. You'd make out through the entire movie. The movie was over. You'd get up. You'd go away. You didn't know her name, and you never saw her again.
And you never saw her again? I don't think I remember that part.
No, I never saw her again, but it was great.
That's a good one, Michael. I like that.
Yeah, we'd walk up and we'd get behind it.
Kids don't have that much fun anymore, I don't think.
No, and it was fun, and it was innocent, and it was great. And nobody ever watched a movie.
No. I don't care what they say. Beach Blanket Bingo was not that popular.
No, absolutely. And let me see. Annette was in. What? No. Annette Funicello was in that. Yes, and also who else?
Frankie Avalon
was in that. You bet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and every once in a while you'd get one of the movies with who else would go poking around in there? We had Anne Margaret, we had Dick Van Dyke. They were doing some movies at that time that were Owen Gidget in the 60s.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, absolutely. You know, it's a world that, let me tell you what I'm glad you did this. It made a legacy out of it. It did something where 100 years from now, somebody can pick the book up and go back and live it.
Well, that's what I'm hoping. And in this particular book, there are 15 DJs, but in the book that I'm working on, that's the full 25 years, that first volume has 41 DJs altogether. The first 15 that are in this one, plus another 26, and then I have three bands. And it goes from large markets to small markets. There are some of the famous DJs like Cousin Brucey and Jimmy Stagg, by the way, who was in Chicago area, and some of the big guys. But then it also tells the stories of some of the small market guys. Bob Dahl, for instance, was... he was a DJ, then he began owning radio stations, and he started the small market radio newsletter, and he did that up until he passed away in 2010. Mm. So, you know, I tell the stories of a lot of the different DJs of the time, and they all have a different behind the microphone attitude, you might say. And some of them liked the music, some of them were in it for the adoration of the fans and the listeners, and some of them like Bob just used it as a stepping stone to get into management. But yeah, they all had a great time, and they knew that they were in an era that was revolutionary, that was so creative. From the 50s through the 70s, there was so much that was going on in our world, in our lives, and in our music.
And you know, I don't know if I still have the interview.
I'm trying to capture some of that.
But Cousin Brucey was out of New York, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I think, yeah, okay, yeah. Because, when was it, 2, 3, 4, yeah, well, we've interviewed him. And what a fun interview that was. Yeah, because you're talking about the past and the rest of it. I remember Wolfman Jack, and it goes beyond there. But what you've got here
And my book is dedicated to him.
Oh, is it? Oh, great. Okay.
Yeah, so it's, my book is dedicated to Wolfman Jack.
Oh, all right, wonderful.
So I have the foreword is by Lonnie Napier, who was his a longtime friend, 25-year friend, and business vice president. And I also have an interview with Frank Mars Cotolo, who was his sidekick for about 15 years.
Wow.
And so they tell some delightful stories. And I was fortunate enough to be able to quote his book, which is Have Mercy. And I don't know if you read that or not, but it is just a scream. And when I talked to Lonnie, he said, that's just a fluff piece. He says, it's only half about what really happened.
Well, yeah, well, when we go back, there's things that you would say to people that they would not. It's almost like speaking a foreign language today, when you'd say the hand jive, the twist, the mashed potato. You know, all of these dances that I can hear music when you say these words, but it's so lost with a lot of the kids today that they would have no idea what you were talking about. That's the kids.
Well, one of the things that I did learn when I was doing the article, actually my 14-year-old niece at that time, she was 14, came down from Washington State and spent a week with me, and I said, you're going to have to follow me around if you want to spend some time with me, because I have to write this article. And we went to one of the local vintage record shops, and we were tooling around town and, you know, getting some research done and everything. And I just turned to her at one point and said, so, what kind of music do you listen to? And I was ready to hear some, you know, names I've never even heard of. And she starts naming off Jimi Hendrix and Led Zeppelin and the Beatles. And I'm going, what are you talking about? She says, there are a huge contingency of young people that really love the rock and roll, the classic rock and roll, and they want to go back and they want to learn about it because it's the base of everything that they listen to now.
Oh, absolutely. I remember as if it was yesterday, there was this little place called Nancy's. Nancy's was a little coffee shop, very tiny. It was one of those little places that you walked in, you can get breakfast, but it sat six people if it sat a lot. no counter, just it was there. It was right next to the market, which was in front of the school. And I remember the jukebox was playing today, and we were in there. And somebody says, that's Elvis. I said, that's who? That's what? Elvis? What's that? And then I remember the same
thing happened.
The
Elvis.
Yeah. And the same thing happened with the Beatles.
Yeah,
you know, the what? And they became, and they were part of the heritage, the tradition, and it's part of what everybody grew up with. It is part of what made the culture of this country, this country.
Yes.
Yeah, because much farther than just music.
Well, the music actually, the rock and roll, I feel, rock and roll actually saved radio at that time, because television was blossoming, and everyone thought that TV was going to supplant radio and it was going to die. Well, rock and roll came along, and it just took off, and that solidified radio in a different way. And so they were, you know, able to coexist, you might say, for a while. But it also, radio was our immediate tie to the world. It was our internet at that time. Television, you still had to wait until 6 o'clock to watch the news. And that was the only news for the day. If you didn't get to watch the 6 o'clock news, you didn't get to see any news. You know, it wasn't like we have it today. And so radio was the connection. And yeah, that lasted.
Wait. Let me hold you up, because we're just about running out of time. One quick thing about radio, when it really comes down to it, radio has always been the constant, even with the internet and the rest of it, because if things go down and you're in trouble, what do they say to have in that emergency pack? A little radio.
Yep, okay, absolutely.
Let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you at?
There is. It's blastfromyourpast.net.
Okay,
and
blastfromyourpast.net. We're going to have to have you back on.
It's also on Amazon.
I'd
love that.
Yeah, let me do that, because for some reason tonight we do not have the best connection in the world. And what's happening, I think there are just about a second or two delay, which is causing us to talk at the same time when they hear it. But let's get Susie to get you back on again, and we'll get you at a better connection, and we will rock. How's that? We'll rock?
I would love that.
Wonderful. Okay, one more time, please, with your website.
blastfromyourpast.net.
Wonderful. Hey, by the way, thank you. I've appreciated this. Now I'm going to be nostalgic for a week.
Good. Call me up if you need to talk some more.
You got it. Okay, thanks.
We'll be nostalgic together. Thank you, Michael. Bye-bye.
We're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
Spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.
Do, 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 do.